This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large for Sunday, April 15th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Mithi Agnihotri Madhokar.
On this edition of Weekend Ozarks, archaeologist Vincent Gaffney from the University of Birmingham, England, discusses Europe's lost land. And a play seeks to uncover secrets of the controversial Norman Baker. He ran an unorthodox cancer hospital in the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs.
In about 5 minutes, we'll also meet with a former Fulbright scholar. But first, a University of Arkansas landmark was returned to its rightful place Monday afternoon. I made a trip to Old Main's West Entrance to partake in the 107th birth anniversary celebration of former United States Senator and Fayetteville native J. William Fulbright. Here's the report.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the first of what will become an annual celebration of the birth of J. William Fulbright.
Dean Robin Roberts of J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas welcomed students, faculty, and other members of the campus community to a gathering yesterday afternoon. The function on the west entrance of Old Main was hosted by Fulbright College to celebrate not only the 107th birth anniversary of its namesake, former United States Senator and Arkansas native J. William Fulbright, but also the return of a statue to the campus.
Many people have commented on how they have missed seeing the statue as they've walked around campus. And I can tell you that especially for those of us who work, teach, and study in this building, his return is very welcome.
Dean Roberts was joined by Associate Dean of Fulbright College, Dr. Charles Adams, and University of Arkansas Chancellor, Dr. G. David Gearhart, both former Fulbright scholars.
Welcome home, Bill Fulbright, and happy birthday. You look pretty good for 107.
According to the director of U of A's Fulbright Institute of International Relations, Professor Hoyt Purvis, who also served as the press secretary and special assistant to J. William Fulbright, the statue of the former university president and U.S. senator was dedicated in October of 2002.
A woman named Greta Bader in Washington, who was a friend of Senator Fulbright's and knew him quite well, she actually executed the sculpture, the statue, and former President Clinton was here. Of course, he had worked in Senator Fulbright's office while he was a student at Georgetown and had a very close relationship with Senator Fulbright. And it also coincided with the 50th anniversary of the German-U.S. Fulbright Exchange Program.
The statue was removed last year due to concerns about its safety and preservation during nearby construction projects. Yesterday's audience was also addressed by Missy Mara Mara, a Fulbright scholar from Philippines who's currently pursuing a Master of Fine Arts degree in drama at the university. Mara Mara said the impact of Fulbright scholarships on enhancing and improving communication among citizens of the world has helped answer the question, quote unquote, how does one bring home the expansive world?
The answer perhaps can be found in what Senator Fulbright said. Educational exchange can turn nations into people, contributing as no other form of communication can to the humanizing of international relations.
Mara Mara is also a member of a registered student organization that represents the many former and current Fulbright scholars from 20 different countries on the University of Arkansas campus. Dr. Gearhart, who visited Oxford University in England as a Fulbright scholar, said that opportunity is the word that describes the scholarship program best.
The Fulbright Fellowship certainly gave me a life-changing opportunity to study at Oxford University, where Senator Fulbright himself once studied. It gave me the opportunity to break out of familiar settings, the opportunity to pursue studies unavailable back at home, and simply the opportunity to see things through an entirely new lens. I find that traveling and studying abroad has the fascinating effect of making the world feel infinitely larger, yet somehow smaller as well.
The return of former U.S. Senator J. William Fulbright's statue to its place of honor at the west entrance to Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus was celebrated yesterday afternoon. The celebration also marked Fulbright's 107th birth anniversary. This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Chase Dodenmeyer is a graduate student in the History Department at the University of Arkansas. In 2010-2011, he spent a year in the Republic of Georgia as a Fulbright Scholar teaching English to high school students. The visit was a result of a conversation Stodenmeyer had with Dr. Kate Mami Seshvili, an assistant professor of higher education at the University of Arkansas and a native Georgian. Both Stodenmeyer and Dr. Mami Seshvili visited KUAF recently to talk with me about his experiences as a Fulbright Scholar in the former Soviet Union state. Stodenmeyer started the conversation by explaining what a Fulbright Scholarship is.
The Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Exchange Program was founded by Senator J. William Fulbright of Arkansas in 1946, and the idea was there were a lot of people at the time who thought that the way to promote peace in the world after the conflict was to actively wage peace, and that the promotion of educational exchange and cultural relations between states would allow things like that to be possible. Senator Fulbright himself had a very formative experience in the 1920s as a Rhodes Scholar in the UK, so he wanted to kind of democratize that process and create that for Americans. And so it's a bilateral exchange program that for every American we're sending somewhere to the world or bringing someone from the world to the United States. And that's a program that has grown and kind of become one of the flagship institutions of American cultural diplomacy.
What were the preparations like? Did you give him some tips about, don't do this in Georgia. Do this in Georgia. Never do this in Georgia.
We talked a little about the history. We talked about the culture. We talked about what Georgians are like, what they like. He did a lot of research himself. I remember one day he showed up in my office with 4 or 5 different books that I did not even exist about Georgia and relationship with Georgian history and the politics in Georgia. So he did a lot of his own research that he did not need too much of my help. But we had conversations before he went.
When you first landed in Georgia, what was your first impression like? Did you have any second thoughts?
I was always proud of the decision, and I don't know if I ever had any second thoughts. Something that was really lucky for me is this was my first time living outside of the United States. I'd been to continental Europe. I'd been to Mexico, Canada. But this was my first time making a serious commitment to try to live and work somewhere that was a foreign environment. And something that attracted me to Georgia is that this is a small state from the former Soviet Union. This is a place that not a lot of Americans have knowledge of or experience with. And so I thought to myself, this will be sufficiently foreign. And that kind of excitement of the unknown is something that was really attractive to me about it. But just the Georgian people, they don't get a lot of foreign guests and a lot of foreign visitors. So when people come, especially Americans, that's a big deal and that's really special. So, you know, it's the closest experience I've ever had to feeling like a celebrity when all of a sudden everyone thinks you're interesting and everyone thinks that everything you do is wonderful. Having Dr. Kate's family there kind of as a surrogate family created a level of security that a lot of other people in my position wouldn't have had. You know, people talk about the experience of having the honeymoon phase somewhere and then becoming really homesick and saying everything about this place is terrible because it's not familiar to me. I was really lucky in that I never had that downswing in the arc of my experience.
Right. But here's the thing. You went to Georgia and you went straight to Kate's hometown. How did that happen?
Well, when I applied for the grant to Georgia, you simply apply to go work in that country. And once you get selected, the cultural affairs staff at the embassy in Tbilisi, they placed us somewhere in the country to work. So I found out about 1 or 2 months before I left for Georgia that I was going to be going to Kutaisi, Dr. Kate's home city. So I had some time to work with her and say, you know, do you know anyone who can help me find an apartment, things like that.
Did that make you nervous, Kate?
I felt a lot of responsibility and some fear that he will not like it in my home country or living in my home city, and how he will like my he was placed in the school, the same school that I went as a child. So I had that fear. What if he? Is he, the biggest fear was, is he going to be safe? It's very safe in Georgia, but is he going to be safe? And I was always telling my family and friends, oh, take care of him and check on him. And they joked, later on they joked, and that he does not need anyone to take care of him. He's taking care of himself and very well.
That was actually one of the only real tensions by the time I was there is, you know, as an American, there's this mindset I've been inculcated into of take care of yourself. I don't want to be dependent on people. And that's really difficult in a foreign country, especially where you don't speak the language. One of the big things about Georgian culture is hospitality for your guests. So I was in an environment where all of these people, part of being a good Georgian is taking care of me and not letting me do things for myself. So it creates this tension where we both have to kind of mutually negotiate what our roles and responsibilities are going to be to each other. But it was great being able to, you know, Dr. Kate has friends who went to school with her who are now teaching in the English faculty at the university in that city. So I could, on a moment's notice, call one of them up and say, this taxi driver is scaring me. Tell him where I want to go. Tell him to slow down.
That is
great. So I had interpreters on call.
That's great. And you also ended up teaching at her school, the school that Kate studied in.
I found out about 1 or 2 months before I went to Georgia that I would be in her home city, but it wasn't until the day that I arrived in that city, about 3 days after arriving in the country, that I found out I was going to be teaching in the school she attended as a child, and that all of the English teachers I was going to be working with there are people who had taught her when she was, you know, in fifth grade, and that her 10th grade niece was in a class that I taught a couple of times while I was there. So it's this crazy small world circumstance.
Now, what were some of the other highlights of your Fulbright scholarship to Georgia? You were an English teacher there, right?
I was given a very broad mandate by the people I was working for at the embassy. They said, there are these two public schools in Kutaisi, and we want you to go there and make yourself useful. And in terms of what that means, if I'm going to be teaching classes every day or if I'm going to be working with extracurricular activities or doing other kinds of projects, I had a lot of freedom to create that. And I guess the big flagship project that I was most proud of and like to talk about, the director at the school that Dr. Kate attended, he approached me one day and said, we'd like to start a drama club at this school. And, you know, there were special schools for the arts in the city in Georgia, but they didn't have the very active, athletic, extracurricular arts programs that we're used to in the United States. So given the opportunity to be a part of something like that, I latched onto it. And I said, why don't we put on a full production of a play in English with a cast of students by the end of the year? Mm. And so that was setting the bar very high. And we had this incredible cast of 15 students out of about 60 that auditioned to be a part of the show, and other English teachers were helping us work out with getting the facilities we needed at the public theater and getting costumes from the theater community. Other students at the school, they built a set. They painted elaborate backdrops for us, so it was this big community involvement. One of the students who was on the cast, a 14-year-old girl, took the entire script that we had, which was an English language script, and translated it into Georgian so that a Georgian theater director could work with the students on, you know, the emotive parts of acting and such.
Right.
So I can't speak to how good the translation was, but he seemed to be giving directions that made a lot of sense. So
okay.
The drama club still continues because they are doing another play this year, and my niece is playing casting in one of the roles, I think. But it's still working.
I mean, I'd like to think we started an institution.
Now, you just talked about, you know, one of the challenges about living in Georgia was this tension between, you know, how independent you should be and how much hospitality would you accept? What were some of the other things that you had to come to terms with, or, you know, you had a little trouble with about Georgian culture or about the country, how things work there?
Well, a stereotype about that part of the world is the relationship with alcohol. But that was one of the most interesting things for me.
I know you would say that.
the first day I showed up in that school, the school that I was working at, I showed up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and that was the first day of school.
Right.
And so I imagined that the school director would be out visiting classrooms and hanging out with his students. But I walked in with a Georgia national who worked at the U.S. Embassy in Georgia, and she interpreted for us, and we kind of talked about, this is your American, have fun with him. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday, and he went to a large, what looked like a bookshelf or cabinet in his office that I assumed was full of books. And when he opened it, it was full of bottles of wine and champagne. And so at 10 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, he pops open that bottle while he's smoking a cigarette inside the building. And we drink a bottle of champagne, the three of us, at 10 o'clock in the morning.
But it's not like people drink there at 10 o'clock in the morning, but right. I think it was part of the hospitality.
Right, a warm welcome of sorts.
Warm welcome of opening champagne or a bottle of wine and hosting the guest.
It's a sociable thing.
Right.
It's a sociable thing, and so that was just a way of welcoming me. 2 weeks after I was there, I went on an excursion, a field trip, with a group of students from the school to an old chapel. It's about 1,000 years old, outside of the city. And we hung out for about an hour, and then it was time for us to have the picnic. And we had brought boxes of food, and then they also brought out 6 2-liter bottles full of beer and a bottle of vodka. And so I'm sitting there with these two other Georgian teachers and a group of 15-year-old students taking vodka shots.
These are
my 15-year-old students. And what's that thing called, the Vaktangani?
Where
you
link
arms. Vaktanguri. Where you link arms and drink together. And everyone wanted to drink with me. And that's perfectly acceptable. It's a social norm. So as an American, where the relationships between myself and my teachers, there's a distancing. There's
right.
a formality that's implied there, you know, pupil figure of authority. In Georgia, every relationship is much more familial. You know, this is a nation of about 5 million people, and all but a few of them live in that country.
Now, a lot of your time in Georgia doesn't only teach you stuff about Georgia, but also what it's like to live in America and what it's like, you know, what life is like in America. What did you learn about America when you were in Georgia?
Part of understanding any personal identity, that identity doesn't really become clear or salient until you experience an other. And so, you know, I made this kind of like the comment about how discovering that things that you assumed are universals are actually cultural variables, that this is not the right way to do things, this is the American way to do things. Something else that I learned is just what a huge responsibility that we have as individuals in this country, and especially thinking about myself as a young American who has a career in front of me that I'd like to have in public service. I was able to sit down and be invited into the home of a man who was a soldier in the Soviet Army in the 1970s, and he was serving in Eastern Germany when my father was a soldier in the United States Army serving in Western Germany. These were two men standing on opposite sides of a conflict, and they didn't know each other, but they knew that they were playing for their team. And to then be able to see 30 years later, I, as a young American, can be invited into his home so graciously, and that he can be fascinated by me, and that he can want to learn about America and have these warm relationships. That says so much about, you know, the burden for my generation, the way in which all whether or not we're successful is when my 25-year-old son, if he can go to Tehran, if he can go to Pyongyang and sit down at a table with someone and be welcomed and have that kind of warm relationship, that's what I see as my obligation as an American today, to kind of pick up the Fulbright mantle to try to actively wage peace, that we don't have to inherit conflicts.
Chase Stodenmeyer is a graduate student in the History Department, and Dr. Kate Mamiseshvili is an assistant professor of higher education at the University of Arkansas. They visited KUAF earlier this month to discuss Todenmeier's experiences as a Fulbright Scholar in the Republic of Georgia.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Professional actor Keith Scales is staging a midnight theater production at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. It's based on the life of Norman Baker, who operated a popular and unorthodox cancer hospital at the Crescent in the 1930s. Shrouded in mystery, Baker has finally been brought to light based on Scales' historic research. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this story.
Some people think of Norman Baker as being like a Nazi butcher. Some people think of him as just a heartless con man, and some people think of him the way he described himself, as a natural healer who was just way ahead of his time and challenged the medical authorities at the time and fell victim to prejudice against experimental medicine.
Keith Scales, a London native, playwright, film, and classical theater actor, moved to Eureka Springs last year from the West Coast to concentrate on the creation of original work for page, stage, and screen. When he learned the Crescent Hotel needed a manager to run its popular ghost tour attraction, he took the job for cash. He oversees 6 tour guides, and that's when he first ran into the legend of Norman Baker, who operated a cancer hospital in the Crescent 80 years ago. And many of the Crescent's ghosts are traced to Baker, who supposedly caused the death of hundreds of patients, filling the hospital morgue in the basement and raising lots of unanswerable questions.
And I would be asked questions by people who were on the tour and pretty much have to fabricate answers to them because a lot of it just did not add up.
But he wanted the facts and was commissioned by the hotel to research Baker's life so that he could script an accurate performance monologue. He traveled to Baker's home in Muscatine, Iowa, to examine the record. Norman Glenwood Baker was born in 1882, one of 10 children to an inventor father and mentally ill mother. Half his siblings, along with his dad, died prematurely. As a young man, he dabbled in vaudeville and mentalism, then later fabricated and patented the first air kaleophone, a portable pipe organ, think circus music, which made him a good deal of money. He eventually found his voice operating his own high-powered transmission radio station in Nuevo Laredo along the Texas-Mexico border, part of the so-called Border Blaster era. Baker preached a positive message to a nation overcome by the Great Depression, also convincing them about natural healing and the power of the mind, inculcating hundreds of thousands of followers, Scales said.
And my perception is that the reason he became interested in it was because there was a lot of money to be made in it.
And savvy at mail order, Baker sold health cures, especially cancer formulas. And in 1929, he opened the Baker Institute in Muscatine to conduct inpatient cancer treatment using his own secret remedy.
I called it secret remedy number 5. We know what was in it. It was herbs. And I can give you the recipe if you like. It was composed of what he called very carefully measured quantities of ground up watermelon seed, red clover, brown corn silk, glycerin, peppermint, and a little carbolic acid as an escharotic.
An escharotic, like zinc oxide or bloodroot, is said to kill cancerous tissue. The other ingredients are today characterized as strong antioxidants. Baker had no medical training or degree, so hired physicians and nurses, likely with questionable references, to administer the injections and treat patients. They did no surgery or x-ray therapy, both conventional cancer treatments at that time.
The fact is that people came to Norman Baker after they had pretty much tried everything else. They were pretty much terminal when they came to Norman Baker, and even though the ingredients that are in those herbs may be great preventatives, I don't believe that they helped anybody who was terminal.
Norman Baker was part of a vocal anti-medical establishment movement that espoused, via his popular radio broadcasts, a philosophy known as natural hygiene, the use of herbal remedies, fresh foods, clean water, and exercise to cure disease, today called naturopathy. But the American Medical Association, founded in 1847 to advance scientific-based standards and practices, saw Baker and others like him as fakes and opportunists. They, conversely, viewed the AMA as a controlling medical monopoly run by powerful Jews. In the end, the AMA shuttered Baker's Muscatine Clinic, as well as another near Laredo. and the then Federal Radio Commission, today the FCC, pressured by the AMA, killed Baker's border radio operation, wrecking his best and most lucrative advertising medium. Still, Baker pushed forward to build a chain of cancer clinics fashioned after the popular holistic Kellogg TB Sanatorium. And he set his sights on a dilapidated Victorian-era health spa in the Ozark Mountains, Eureka Springs.
In 1937, there were 1,700 people here desperate for somebody to come from outside and provide some work for the locals. The Crescent Hotel had been sitting empty for 3 years, and it was going cheap, and it was an existing facility. So he bought this place and the two parks around it, 28 acres altogether, for $40,000, and converted it into a cancer-curable hospital as the first step towards something that would rival the Mayo Clinic in his imagination.
He said about investing another $50,000 to renovate the Crescent into a 100-bed medical facility, complete with a penthouse suite for himself. The Baker Hospital opened in 1938. There's no written record of why he did this, Scale said, but Baker painted portions of the hotel using what appears to be sacred geometry and chromotherapy or color therapy. The theory goes that color stimulates certain healing responses. Red benefits the kidneys, green promotes good heart function, blue helps the throat. Baker himself was smitten with the color purple. He wore it, drove a lavender convertible, and painted the hotel in it. Supposedly, and there's no indication that Baker espoused this, purple stimulates the nervous system, cerebral cortex, and pituitary gland, and connects to universal energies, as well as transmits ideas and information.
When he took the hotel over, it had been sitting empty for 3 years, and before that, for a quarter of a century, it was a conservatory for young ladies. So it was very somber and Victorian. And he came in and he painted it in the most garish colors. His defenders say that it was Art Nouveau. I think it looked more like a circus. And his justification was that he wanted a place where people could feel cheerful and healthy and actually get better and would lift their spirits rather than a dull place where they could sit around and feel miserable.
You can still see remnants of Baker's chromotherapy on the hotel's purple brick chimneys. And according to the record, U.S. Congressman Claude Fuller, a native and then patriarch of Eureka Springs, claimed that Baker Hospital brought great prosperity to Eureka Springs.
Claude Fuller, who was a congressman in Eureka Springs and initially at least a friend of Baker's, told Congress that at any given time, Baker had 500 to 600 people in Eureka Springs taking his alternative cancer treatment. What that means is that they could not all be accommodated in the Crescent Hotel, so everybody in town was opening up rooms thanks to Norman Baker. Everybody was making a lot of money here.
Keith Scale says we don't know much about Baker's personality, but according to old photographs, Baker was exceedingly handsome. And combined with his mentalist abilities, he could sway an audience.
This was a man with many faces, as well as many talents, and many ways of manipulating other people. It does seem that people who knew him very well didn't come off very well from the relationship. People who didn't know him at all thought he was charming, until he got to know him very well and tried to do business with him, and he always came out the winner.
But in the end would lose a protracted and very public battle with the AMA that sought to crush Baker and others like him, most notably John Brinkley and Harry Hoxsey, also making millions off natural cures, some of them extreme. 20 months after the Baker Hotel in Eureka Springs opened, it closed. The AMA contended Baker was practicing medicine without a license, preying especially on uneducated working poor and the desperate. That charge never stuck, but he was tried in federal court in Little Rock.
He was charged with fraud, fraudulent use of the U.S. mails. And the fraud was that he was bringing people to Eureka Springs on the promise that he could cure them when he knew he couldn't. Well, they convicted him.
While in prison, Scale says, Baker invented a power of thought mail order course based on the theory of auto-suggestion. And after his release, He attempted once more to open a health facility at Muscatine, but failing that, moved to Miami, Florida, where he lived for the next 15 years on a yacht owned by railroad tycoon and robber baron Jay Gould. Baker died in Florida in 1958 from cirrhosis of the liver, complicated by a carcinoma. Although he married briefly younger in his life, he had no descendants. Court case documents, Keith Scales found, state that Baker had accumulated $4 million in profits, equivalent to $52 million today.
And nobody knows what he did with all his money, because he never put money in banks, or very, very little. He kept it, what he said was, a cold, hard cash in a good hiding place. That's my idea of financial security. And so there's a lot of money still missing.
And Baker Hospital medical records have long disappeared. So who ended up surviving treatment and who ended up in the Baker Hospital morgue will never be known.
And one of the sightings that has been reported over the years is that people in the laundry have seen a man walking through wearing a white suit and a purple shirt on his way apparently to the area which is now the maintenance department, but used to be the morgue.
Norman Baker, checking on the status of his supply chain? Maybe. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
At the bottom of the North Sea is a lush plain that not that long ago, at least not that long ago in geological time, was home to hunter-gatherers. But rising sea levels completely submerged the land, now called Doggerland, by the year 5500 BC. Vincent Gaffney, the chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham in England, is the leader of the North Sea Paleo Landscapes Project. That project is using 3D seismic data to further study the area. This week, he was on the University of Arkansas campus. Monday, he discussed the study of Doggerland. Before that lecture, he stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
In the last 20,000 years, the shape of the world changed dramatically. Large portions of the land, terrestrial land, were inundated as the temperature warmed, as the glaciers retreated in the northern hemisphere, and sea level rose, and it covered up areas which had been home to men and women for thousands and thousands of years. These were areas which people knew, the hills they were named, the rivers they knew, the land they lived on, and they were just lost to history and memory.
But now, thanks to technology developed thousands of years later, we can learn more about it, can't we?
Absolutely. And the area we're talking about, just to give you some sort of idea, the area I work in is Northwest Europe, and that's sort of bounded by France, Britain, and Norway. And at the time we were talking about, initially from 18,000 BC, the frontier of Europe was up near Norway. Britain wasn't an island, everyone's very used to, I think, the shape of Britain, and the British are very used to the shape of Britain, and you know, we define ourselves as an island race. But then it was just a range of hills on the edge of Europe, nothing more. And over time, the world changed what it is today, and you know that makes us in many ways. But in the past, it was very different, and now we've managed to find ways of starting to explore that.
I would imagine that it has been for some time difficult to study. I mean, you're talking underwater.
Let me tell you just how difficult and why this is quite so interesting. 10 years ago, I regularly held a seminar on strange landscapes, and in one of those seminars, we treated the Mesolithic. Now, the Mesolithic is the Middle Stone Age. It's a period from about 10,000 BC through to about 5,000 to 4,000 BC in the British Isles, and it's interesting for one specific reason for me, because in 1931, a British trawler called the Kalinda was pulling in its nets, and the skipper, a guy called Pilgrim Lockwood,
that's a great name,
wonderful name, was breaking up the Moorlog. Now, the Moorlog were great big bits of peat that were scraped up from the bottom of the seabed. And he was hacking, all these things did, were cumbersome for the fishermen because they damaged the nets, they bruised fish, they didn't want this stuff, but they kept on dragging it up. And they had for at least 100 years previously. And, you know, mechanized trawling produced even more of the stuff. But he was hacking a meter cube of this stuff up when his shovel hit something. And he pulled it apart, and inside was a rather beautiful bone harpoon.
Huh.
And it had inscribed lines on it. It was serrated, and he looked at it and he thought, that's interesting. I rather think he thought he could sell it, because he actually says he found it by taking this big lump of stuff down into his cabin, and he broke it open just to see what it was before the rest of the men. But he took it back to Britain, and it went to the British Museum, and it was studied, and they said, yes, this is from this period called the Mesolithic, and it's rather interesting. Why is it out in the middle of the North Sea, near the Lamanadua Banks, which is not far from the famous Dogger Banks in the North Sea? And he then showed it to some academics in Cambridge, and they looked at it, and they said, this is interesting, because we don't think it was just dropped in the middle of the North Sea. Some passing person on a canoe didn't drop it. And what they did was they actually took a sample of the peat from nearby, and they analysed it through the pollen that was held in the material, and they realised that at that point in time the area had been dry land.
Huh.
And it wasn't just a passing boat. It had to be someone walking across the North Sea. Now, that shouldn't have been such a surprise, because 20 years earlier, a guy called Clement Reid, who was a member of the British Geological Survey, had in his retirement produced a book on submerged forests. Now, he had looked at forests which were fossilised but were preserved below the waterline, and he'd realised that at some point areas much beyond the terrestrial landmass of Britain must have been dry land. And by studying these, he had suggested that all the area below the 36-metre bathymetric point, that's about 100 metres below sea level, must have been dry land. And he realised that the North Sea itself would have been a great big plain. Now, he understood it was important. He said that this is an area where people would have been better to live there than anywhere else at that point in time. But he couldn't date when this land existed, and it was inaccessible. And he made this comment. He said, well, even though everything an archaeologist might wish to study might be there, preserved underwater, all the wood, the textiles and everything else, he said, actually, what I think is going to happen is that the geologists are going to look at this and say too recent, and the archaeologists are going to look at it and say too old, and everyone is going to pass on. And he's absolutely quite right. That was actually what happened, until the find from the Kalinda.
If you are in the study of geology or archaeology or a related field, this is not surprising to you. But, you know, you're asking lay people to rethink about the world in a way they're not used to. And it kind of grounds you, I think, to realize that things do change and can change again.
Yes, and perhaps it's an appropriate tale for current times. There is, of course, a huge debate upon climate change, but this period we're talking about was the last one during which climate change of a scale that we are anticipating occurred within the world. Now, I'm not saying it was man-made. That would be preposterous. It's an entirely natural event. And you may derive whatever you wish about the current debate about what is driving climate change. But the chances are that climate change is real, and chances are it is likely to be catastrophic, and to some extent it is likely to be catastrophic. You have to put against that what happened 20,000 years ago through to about 5,500 BC. During that time, Europe lost 20-30% of its land area. Mm. The people who lived in that land were pushed off. There is undoubtedly evidence for a rise in violence during this time. There's evidence for changes possibly in respect of land ownership and tenurial patterns, possibly caused by stress from movements of population at various times. Well, we can be quite sure that the change which was enforced at this time was problematic and deeply distressing, but people had the capacity to change. They were probably able to move. The population stabilised in a land that was generally underpopulated. In the future, where are all our cities? Mm-hmm. They are all on the coasts.
Right.
Where are these people going to go if there is major climate change and sea level rise again? Now, I'm not going to suggest that the scale of rise will occur in exactly the same way. There was about 120 metres rise after 18,000 BC. Mm. Now, that may not happen, but relatively small amounts of change is likely to have large impacts on large populations around the world.
Is there any way to know how quickly that rise happened?
Well, the pace of change is very difficult. We really do not have that information at the moment. It will require a lot more evidence for that refined chronology. I mean, we know where the coastline started at the end of the last ice age. And we know where we begin, but the change was probably not linear.
Right.
There were major changes in quite short times when for instance, great ice lakes in North America, the dams burst. There were rapid changes in sea level rise in the North Sea as well. So that could happen very rapidly. In most cases, the change was insidious. It took a long time, but at other periods, it could have been quite short periods.
Vincent Gaffney is the chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham in England and the leader of the North Sea Paleo Landscapes Project, studying the area at the bottom of the North Sea called Doggerland. And tonight at 6:30, as part of the Sigler Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas, he'll discuss the secrets of Stonehenge.
Yes, we'll be looking at real secrets. We're going to be looking in between the monuments of Stonehenge, at the areas where people have never looked and finding out what is there.
That's part of the discipline here, right? Looking where people haven't looked before.
Absolutely.
But with Doggerland and with Stonehenge.
Yeah, people should always understand most of the world is actually terra incognita. It has never been explored.
Vincent Gaffney is the chair in landscape archaeology and geomatics at the University of Birmingham in England and the leader of the North Sea Paleo Landscapes Project, studying the area at the bottom of the North Sea called Doggerland. He delivered a Stigler lecture this week on the University of Arkansas campus. The Stigler Lecture Series is sponsored by the Department of Anthropology, the Department of Geosciences, and the Environmental Dynamics Program. It is Sunday, the 15th of April, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri Matholkar.
With us is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
We're all adjusting.
Yes.
Kitties. Big kitties.
I know what you're talking about then.
We're talking about Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge.
Lions and tigers.
It's turning 20.
When is the anniversary?
The anniversary is like the 19th, but they're going to celebrate for 2 or 3 weeks.
Because, you know, the 24th is the 20th anniversary of Walton Arts Center having its first show.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're ancient.
No.
She's not.
No.
But we are.
So the 20th anniversary at Turpentine Creek.
They have 115 big cats and bears, you know, lions and tigers mm-hmm. and bears, oh my. The newest is Thor, mm-hmm. who had worked in movies and ended up doing like convention center gigs. And he is having some health issues, but he's getting better. And he's not the worst that they've seen since Tanya Smith and her parents opened Turpentine Creek in 1992. Her parents started taking in critters when her dad saw a lion cub at a used car lot and brought it home.
And realized that was not a good place for it.
Right. And then they were offered 42 big cats in three cattle trailers that needed a home. That was in 1991. And then they sold everything they had and bought this property up by Eureka Springs, thinking it would be a good place because of the poultry industry. Because these little critters eat 1,000 pounds of meat a day in the summer and nearly 2,000 in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
115 cats, 6 black bears, and a grizzly bear.
Yes.
Hmm.
Did you see the grizzly bear?
I don't remember seeing a grizzly there.
I don't think it was there when
there was a brown bear or a black bear.
I did see it last summer. So
yeah. Okay. No,
did you see the liger?
I did.
They don't have
a liger.
I think the liger is passed.
No, they still have a liger.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, yeah. They have a couple of ligers.
Yeah, I want to see a liger. Anyway, the point of this is that starting Thursday, they are celebrating. Mm-hmm. They're going to have movies. On Friday, they're going to have an Artful Tigers auction, which with live music and a silent art auction at Matt Miller Studios in Fayetteville. They have a dinner at Castle Rogues Manor on Saturday. They have a cat walk-a-thon on the 22nd.
What are the movies?
The first movie is The Lion King, of
course.
There
you
go. And then there's another movie on April 26th, Two Brothers. And then they have A Taste with the Tigers, food samples from area restaurants on the 27th. You can find out more about all this today in the Our Town section of Northwest Arkansas newspapers. And it all ends with a fireworks display on May 5th.
All right.
That'd be nice.
This afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
The second day of the Spring Gem and Mineral Show at the Siloam Springs Community Center. That's from 10 to 4. Jim Curry's tribute to John Denver is at 2 o'clock at the Air and Art Center in Bentonville. The matinee of No Sex, Please, We're British. Obviously a British farce at Rogers Little Theater. That's at 2 o'clock. The matinee of The Fall of the House, a new mystery by Bob Ford, is at 2 o'clock at Theater Square. There's also a 7 o'clock show today. And Sunday night stand-up at the UARC Bowl at 7:30. No reason to be bored.
Busy Sunday.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is the features editor with Not Just Arkansas Newspapers.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 15th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of Henry James, author of 20 novels, 112 stories, 12 plays, and several books of travel and criticism. Born in New York City, 1843. Father was a friend of Thoreau, Emerson, Hawthorne. Family traveled throughout Europe. When Henry James was in his 20s and writing short stories, he moved to Europe because he could live cheaply there. And he fell in love with England. He wrote, "The capital of the human race happens to be British." What he really wanted to be, though, was a dramatist. But one of his plays was poorly received, and James himself was booed on opening night, and that discouraged him. He never earned much money from his writing, nor did he win the acclaim that he had hoped for. His friend Edith Wharton lobbied for him to win the Nobel Prize to no avail. And towards the end of his life, James got a generous advance from Scribner's for a new book, an advance that actually secretly came from Edith Wharton. It was on this day, 1802, William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy were walking along the banks of Ulswater Lake, 9 miles long in the Lake District, and they happened upon a profusion of daffodils. Dorothy wrote down a description of the daffodils, and Wordsworth wrote the poem 5 years later that begins, "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils beside the lake beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze." It's the birthday of Leonardo da Vinci. Born Leonardo di Ser Piero da Vinci in Vinci, Italy, 1452, best known for his Mona Lisa and The Last Supper, two of the most famous paintings in the world. But he left fewer than 30 paintings when he died, and most of those were unfinished. He was a perfectionist and a procrastinator. Having worked on the Mona Lisa on and off for the last 15 years of his life, he was drawing up plans for inventions like the submarine, the helicopter, the armored tank, and the alarm clock, none of which came to fruition in his life. Here's a poem for today by Philip Booth entitled Wear. I hate how things wear out. Not elbows, collars, cuffs, they fit me, lightly frayed. Not belts or paint or rust, not routine maintenance. On my own hook, I cope with surfaces, with all that rubs away, flakes off, or fades on schedule. What eats at me is what wears from the inside out, bearings, couplings, universal joints, old differentials, rings and points, frictions hidden in such dark they build to heat before they come to light. What gets to me is how valves wear, the slow leak in old circuitry, the hairline fracture under stress. With all my heart, I hate pumps losing prime, immeasurable overloads, ungauged fatigue in linkages. I hate myself for wasting time on hate. The cost of speed came with the bill of sale. The rest was never under warranty. 5 years ago, I turned in every year. This year, I rebuilt parts. What hurts is how blind tired I get. The poem entitled Where by Philip Booth from Lifeline Selected Poems, published by Viking, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Nick Vetter, engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
RLT continues its 26th main stage season with the comedy No Sex, Please, We're British, running now through April 22nd. This British farce revolves around a young couple receiving an incorrect order of Scandinavian pornography, which is chaotically complicated by friends and family. 631-8988 or rogerslittletheater.org for tickets or more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Cane Hill, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, pursuing peace through education at arkansas.edu/Fulbright.
Have you ever been to Cane Hill?
I did. As a matter of fact, I accompanied Jacqueline Froelich when she visited Tahlequah. So that's how I remembered it.
It's a neat little place. A lot of history.
Yes.
A lot of history there.
I also want to remind our listeners, I don't know if I should or not, but today is the 100th anniversary
of the sinking of the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And I will tell you that Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF, 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri Matholkar.
Have a great Sunday.
Happy Sunday.